Classic Business with Michael Avery, sponsored by Alex Forbes, for insight, advice, and impact.
Due diligence on Classic Business is brought to you by Deal Leaders International, leaders in mergers and acquisitions. Now, when buying a business, it's certainly critical to consider a whole host of different issues, including obviously the assets in the business, the value, the price that you're paying, and the apportionment of business responsibility and warranties, and the list goes on. To learn more about some of these critical issues to consider in this purchase process, we're joined now by Jaco Meyer from the corporate and commercial practice at top South African law firm Klifdekker Hofmeyr. Jaco, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, let's start at the very top here. What are the advantages of pursuing a business acquisition instead of purely just acquiring shares in the business, a share acquisition?
Michael, there are quite a few reasons why someone would prefer a business acquisition as opposed to a share acquisition. And I think I can briefly summarize those into three points. Firstly, the structure of a business acquisition allows for more flexibility to structure the deal in such a manner that the buyer can carve out certain assets and liabilities specifically relating to the business, whereas in a share acquisition, the buyer acquires the company or the group companies with all its assets and liabilities, whether they relate to the underlying business or not. A business acquisition also allows for a more focused due diligence investigation for the buyer to look at the specific risks of liability associated with the business, whereas a due diligence in respect of a share sale, the buyer has to look at the entire company or the group companies as a whole. And then lastly, there may be some tax benefits to a business acquisition, particularly when the business is acquired as a going concern, where the transaction will be zero VAT rated, as opposed to a share sale, where you will inevitably pay share transfer tax in terms of the Security Transfer Tax Act.
And how can I ensure that I don't assume any of the seller's liabilities incurred before the transfer, including any employee-related liabilities? Does this help solve for that?
So the rule of thumb is generally that the seller will be liable for all liabilities up to and including the closing date.
Right.
And that the buyer takes on the responsibility for those liabilities on and from the closing date. Now, of course, that does allow for some negotiation between the parties, and there are certain things that would need to be taken into account. For example, if you have to pay rent in advance and that rent needs to be paid at the beginning of the month or just before transfer takes place, the seller would pay that rent and then get reimbursed by the buyer for that rent. The inverse of that, of course, is when, for example, employee commission gets paid in arrears for the period leading up to the closing date. That can be paid by the buyer, and then the buyer can be reimbursed by the seller. There are, of course, other certain employee liabilities that the buyer would need to take on, or that the buyer or the seller can agree to take on. This is generally dealt with in terms of the Labor Relations Act, in terms of Section 197, to give you a broad idea. In terms of Section 197, they can agree whatever they want, but generally the seller is liable for the employee's accrued leave up to the closing date. And although not a technical liability, the buyer would be liable for any severance packages paid after the date of transfer. But that is, of course, open for negotiation between the parties.
Yeah, and also why you need to enter into these negotiations, being fully apprised of this to ensure that it doesn't slip through when you're dotting those I's and crossing the T's. What are some of the considerations that you think should be given to apportioning prepayments to or by the seller when we come to things like rent and rates?
Certainly. Michael, so I think it's actually quite a relatively practical solution. You need to discuss this with your financial advisor as well. You need to practically consider whether you can actually allocate costs and expenses and even revenue as before or after the transfer date, and then allocate that accordingly. You then also need to make sure that is reflected in your income statement to the revenue authorities. Otherwise, in some instances, you may find that the transfer date or the closing date are different, and then you have what they deem an interim period during that period where the seller undertakes to conduct the business in the ordinary course. And during that period, you need to identify where the cost lies, whether it's for the benefit of the seller or the buyer. And to address this issue, the transaction agreement should clearly allocate the responsibility for the business's income and expenses during the interim period, and the party should ensure that their tax filings are consistent with this allocation.
Now, I mean, this sounds all fairly straightforward, but often what we find in deals of this nature is skeletons that might be in the closet somewhere that a seller might try to hide from a potential inquirer. So can you just give us some insight into some of the main challenges that can arise when negotiating transaction agreements and transaction terms in this way?
Certainly, Michael. So every transaction inevitably has its own, let's call them challenges, that pop up in one that may not pop up in another one. And there certainly are sometimes a few skeletons hidden in a closet that you need to shake out. And a thorough due diligence process does help quite a bit to identify the most important areas of risk and liability associated with the business. This can help ensure that the warranties that you would, that the buyer would seek, are tailored to address the specific risk and liabilities associated with the business. I'm sure you know, and I'm sure your listeners know, that warranties are expressed as statements of facts in relation to the business, yeah. If something is true or not true in the business. But the buyer needs to holistically consider what warranties are important to it in relation to the business, taking into account the due diligence process, and also taking into account the type of business that is being acquired. For example, in a services business, the IP, or the intellectual property rights associated with the business, will be the focus of the warranties, whereas in a manufacturing company, the warranties may focus on the condition of the equipment and the facilities. Now, of course, there are certain instances where these overlap, but it is, as every lawyer will tell you, it depends on the facts of the case.
Yeah, absolutely. On the one hand and on the other, to borrow from an economist friend of mine as well. But I guess the bottom line here for a potential acquirer is ensuring that you structure those warranties to address all of the critical and material information about the business. Obviously, depending on its nature, as you said, what kind of sector is it in, what kind of concern that it's in as well. In case of a breach of warranty, what are the options for claiming damages? I mean, it's the last place you want to find yourself because, as you said, in litigation, often it's also only the lawyers and the billable hours that win. But what are your options?
Michael, I always advise a practical approach in the first instance. I would always prefer that the parties try and negotiate a mutually beneficial outcome, whether that being renegotiating the terms of the agreements, providing the buyer with compensation, or actually addressing the issue that caused the underlying breach of warranty. If that doesn't work, the buyer can always claim damages, and you often see damages clauses in, or breach clauses in these transaction agreements that are accompanied by an indemnity clause, which effectively provides some protection to the buyer where the seller indemnifies the buyer against any damages suffered by it. Of course, as soon as you see an indemnity clause, you can anticipate that the seller will seek to limit the liability under those indemnities for those damages. In significant circumstances of breach, the buyer may also be able to terminate the agreement.
Now, it gets quite technical, but can you just explain the apportionment of responsibility when it comes to the interim undertakings and the effective date of transfer for accounting purposes? Because often this is where some deals can get tripped up.
Certainly. So the effective date of transfer for accounting purposes refers to the date on which legal ownership of the assets and the business and the liabilities pass from the seller to the buyer. This date may differ from the completion date of or the closing date of the transaction, which is the date on which the parties physically complete all the necessary steps to transfer ownership. Now, in relation to the apportionment of responsibility, that refers to the process of allocating the rights, the responsibilities, and the liabilities between the buyer and the seller in the sale transaction, particularly in relation to the interim period between the signing being the effective date for the accounting purposes and completion being the physical steps they take. In these instances, you'll find interim period undertakings, which are agreements between the buyer and the seller to conduct the business. Usually you'll see in the ordinary course during the interim period, and they may include requirements for the seller to maintain the business in a particular condition, some restrictions on the seller's ability to take certain actions, or obligations on the seller to continue to operate the business in a manner consistent with past practices, and to notify the buyer of anything if anything pops up.
Yeah, and I think what it demonstrates, and we've really just touched the surface, there's so much more to get through, but we're running out of time, is the sale and purchase of a business is usually more complex and comprehensive than just a sale and transfer of shares, and clearly can take a longer time to implement. And as Michael Katz once said to me, the more time you introduce into a potential transaction, the greater the risk as well. Just in conclusion, Jaco, what are the best practices should be followed to ensure a successful business acquisition process?
I think to summarize it broadly, Michael, it's to negotiate key deal terms carefully and reasonably. I think you raised earlier about litigation being sort of inherently combative and parties not fighting, but they're trying to one up the other. But I think in an M&A context, the parties are generally working towards a mutually beneficial outcome, and they should approach negotiations with that in mind and should be able to compromise on certain aspects to make sure the deal gets done.
Thank you very much, Jaco Meyer from the Corporate and Commercial Practice at Cliff Dekker Hofmeyr, talking about how we navigate the complexities of business acquisitions in this week's Due Diligence on Classic Business, as always, brought to you by Deal Leaders International, partnering with you.
The question should not be to sell or not to sell. Instead, the question is to sell or to grow. Deal Leaders International is a professional sell-side mergers and acquisitions advisory firm with years of experience in the trenches that can provide you with an analysis of your business and the market so you can make the best decision on whether to exit or grow your business. Email connect@dealleadersint.com. Deal Leaders International, partnering with you.
Classic Business with Michael Avery, sponsored by Alex Forbes, for insight, advice, and impact.